The Guardian.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. My name is Ellis James and I'm standing in for Max Rushton this week. Max can't be with us, I'm afraid, as he is the guest speaker at Nature's Lukewarm Pleasure, a three-day residential course in Sussex that teaches burnt-out millennials to stop staring at their phones and relax by making love. The course is a mere £1,800 plus VAT, and Max is taking bookings for 2020, as in his words, this problem isn't going away. My guests this week... It's the Jan Agerfjordtoft for the WhatsApp generation. It's Lars Siverton. Lars, how are you?
I thought that was going to be the other guest, but sure, I'll take it.
Well, I wrote you first because I assumed you'd sit in my seat.
Okay.
We have this conversation every time we do the pod. It's the Ellis Lars seat. We fought over it in the past.
I just think you're a more versatile performer. I think if you move me out of this, it'll all go completely wrong, whereas you're a little bit more, you've got more strings to your bow.
You're too kind. Far too kind. Okay then. To my right, Catenaccio, Azzurri, Bandini, the three words that crystallise Italian football. Paolo, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
What did you have for your breakfast this morning?
I had a pan of chocolate this morning for breakfast from outside Brighton train station.
I mean, it's a very, very cosmopolitan picture you paint. But finally, to my left, the most radical thinker to come out of Ireland since Maeve Binchy. Football journalism's premier mischief maker is Barry Glendenning. Barry, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Ellis.
I assume you've read all of her work?
I have read some of her work.
What's it like?
It's not really my cup of tea. It's I suppose she's the grandmother of chick lit.
Is she? Is that how you would classify Maeve Binchy? Is it racy in any way?
I think it was probably kind of racy when I read it,
right,
but then
okay.
I was very easily pleased.
I
suspect I picked it up on holidays as a child somewhere. It was probably raining in Donegal and there was nothing to read, so I found a Maeve Binchy book.
And suddenly you had the sexual awakening you've been waiting for. Oh, God. Well,
I seem to remember nuns being involved, but not in a racy way.
All right, so the nuns didn't have sex.
No.
Thankfully. So who was having... Sorry, I hate to dwell on this. Who's having sex in Maeve Binchy novels?
This was a very long time ago. The book I read was turned into a movie, and I think it involved girls in one of those, you know, labour camps run by nuns in Ireland back in the day. And I think one of them, you know, a lot of those girls would be there because they'd got themselves in trouble.
Okay. So it's social commentary as well as titillation.
Yes.
Well,
probably more social commentary than titillation.
I am going straight on Amazon as we speak. What I'm going to do first, let's cover it. It's the Champions League Battle of Britain. So I've started talking like I'm doing a tabloid podcast, but still, Tottenham Hotspur 1, Manchester City 0. Son scoring on 78 minutes. Paolo, what did you make of it?
I made of it what I think a lot of people made of it, that it was first of all a really compelling 90 minutes of football. I think a lot of us were surprised by Pep Guardiola's lineup and
his agricultural tactics.
Well, just at the most sort of surface level, how on earth you can be leaving someone as brilliant as Kevin De Bruyne on the bench for distinctly underwhelming Riyad Mahrez. I thought they just... Jonathan Wilson wrote about it for the paper on Wednesday, and I thought he wrote it well. It just seems like Pep is outthinking himself now in these European games. It's the 10th European game without a win away from home. Sorry, 10th Champions League knockout game away from home without a win for him. And it just felt like... hard to explain it any other way. It was an odd lineup. It does feel like he... whilst City have generally done pretty well against Tottenham, he does seem to sort of really perhaps over-respect their physicality and feel like he needs to adjust his lineups to play to them rather than playing with the confidence of a team that's won 22 of its previous 23 games. It just seemed like a really oddly I don't know, reactive and an unconfident performance from a team that's got City's recent record, and they paid for it. And yes, of course, things could go differently. Of course, if Sergio Aguero puts that penalty away, we're looking at a very different result. And who knows, maybe even if Harry Kane stays on the pitch, we're looking at a different result, because Son has this ridiculous record of always delivering when Kane isn't there. But I thought Tottenham were good value for the win.
The way Pochettino and Tottenham play football under Pochettino should actually be quite well suited to disrupt Man City. It's an interesting thing that the top manager who has the best record against Guardiola is Klopp by some margin. And the theory behind that is both at Liverpool and at Dortmund has had this sort of hard-pressing, heavy metal team that disrupts City's flow and doesn't let them get into their passing rhythm. And that's something that we know puts Guardiola off a bit. He even, you know, once at Bayern, he set up to sort of whack it long to Javi Martinez all day just to get past the press. Last season, he kind of freaked out and played an extra midfielder at Anfield in the Champions League. So this is something we know worries Pep, this sort of the heavy pressing teams. So you'd think then that Tottenham under Pochettino would be well sorted to trouble them. But that hasn't really been the case so far. Since Guardiola came, they've played five times, and Pochettino's lost three of them, won once and drawn once before last night. And I think what I expected, that I did see the game that structurally Spurs could trouble City, but what you'd expect to do is for the individual sort of game-deciding moments to break against Spurs, just because they've been a bit off recently. So I expected them to sort of cock it up, for lack of a better phrase. But what actually happened was the opposite. It was the individual moments that won it for them. It was the Lloris penalty save. It was the Son goal. So rather than actually being undone by individual errors, they triumphed through individual moments, which was completely the opposite of what I thought would happen.
Well, it's funny because it's almost irrelevant to mention it, because nothing comes of it at all at the end of the game. But I just thought it interesting that Lloris had that night where he makes a penalty save, good penalty save. But right at the end of the game, in injury time, I think, he flaps horribly across. And it doesn't matter, because it doesn't fall anywhere dangerous. It gets cleared. I just thought these are the margins on which we get to tell the narratives of individual players. Lloris's night was a great night because he saved the penalty, but it wasn't what it could have been if that had gone differently.
It's been an odd year for Lloris, because he has made more mistakes than you'd want a goalkeeper at that level. But he has also had, you know, the penalty save against Leicester was really important for Spurs this season. Penalty save against Arsenal, obviously. He had a really great save in the first half against Dortmund. And now a really crucial save here, so he has come up big in certain moments as well.
He does seem to be a scapegoat for Spurs fans, though, doesn't he, Lloris, when something goes wrong?
I don't think he's had a good season, though, overall, since that drink driving charge after the World Cup. He has been responsible for a series of clangers, which you wouldn't expect from a goalkeeper of his stature and, you know, a World Cup winning goalkeeper. Just on the subject of City, I think it's probably fair to say, and people, it does seem to be the thing to say, Pep is overthinking, but I think he was possibly thinking about being 3-0 down against Liverpool after, you know, at halftime in last year, at previous games against Monaco, when City conceded a skipful, and that would possibly explain his caution and why he played Ilkka Gundogan alongside Fernandinho. But if I was a City fan, I wouldn't be hugely concerned. You know, it's half time, they're 1-0 down, and they're at home in the second leg. It's wouldn't be reaching for the panic button just yet.
So what I think that's all totally fair. I still think, especially once Tottenham have scored, the away goal does matter in this context. Okay, the fact that you haven't scored one, the fact that if Tottenham now come to City and score even once, you leave yourself with a lot to do. Why is he waiting till the 89th minute to then make a triple substitution? I found that really odd.
I found that baffling as well. The only thing is, I mean, what minute was it that Son scored?
A double substitution, sorry.
78, I think it was.
Yeah,
the 78th minute.
Pep generally, rather than, you know, arbitrarily make his own decision, seems to need to discuss it with all his backroom staff before he makes you know, he's very fair-minded in that way. And maybe it just, there just
well,
seems to be
substitution by committee.
Yeah, and maybe that's how long it took, but there seems no rhyme or reason to leave it till the 89th minute. You know, there's very little they can do in that time.
I would love I would love for him to explain in a press conference why he did that, actually. Because, you know, I don't know. I never played football at the highest level. Maybe there is some grand theory behind it, but I don't know what it would be.
Generally, when substitutions are made in the 89th minute, it's to waste time.
It's to run down the clock, yeah.
And
maybe he thinks, because it is half-time in the tie, they're actually going to play all 180 minutes of it last night. He thought he had 90 minutes to play with. But yeah, it's a very, very odd decision. It was a very odd decision from him.
I do think on the selection as well, playing Dalesfelt left back. I mean, Delph has started, what, 3 games in 2019? I mean, you have the option of, I don't know, maybe Stone was hurt or something, but you have the option of moving Laporte out to the left back where he played against Liverpool, where he played against Arsenal. And it's something they've done before, and that seems to work. And again, going on to what Paolo says, I mean, we do tend to build huge narrative arcs around these individual things, but I mean, Delph didn't do brilliantly for the Son goal, I didn't think. So it's worth raising the point, I think.
Yeah, and it seemed to me that Tottenham had a very deliberate tactic of pressing especially high on the two fullbacks. And Kyle Walker obviously has had his hamstring injury recently. As you say, Fabian Delph, he's not someone who's necessarily totally an ideal option at a fullback. Obviously, then, does wind up being involved in one of the game's most sort of significant incidents, which is that challenge with Harry Kane, which I guess another talking point from this game. I thought it was, I suppose you could say ironically, because he was getting kicked to pieces a bit before that, but I thought Kane was very much the aggressor in that situation, and when Delph gets an earful from Pochettino, it's quite unfair.
Well, he's not going to play in the second leg, or looking likely he won't play. There's this fantastically, I think, misleading statistic where their win rate is actually better without Harry Kane. That said, they've got to go to Manchester without him. Do you think they can cope, Lars?
I would want to look at the sample size, as you say, and which game, yeah. which were those 9 games. But there was something about how they seemed to find some kind of flow with Son up front, and that their form took a significant dip when Kane came back. I mean, I do recall that's how it went, and it's probably a complete coincidence. But it's interesting that Son scored almost immediately after that, saying Kane came off. And I think with Kane not there, he perhaps, when he's playing up front, he feels more freedom to drift around and take up the positions where he feels he can do the most damage, and he doesn't have to relate quite so much to where Kane is on the pitch. So for Son, it's probably better.
I think if nothing else, especially when it happens in a game like this, it's a different way of playing with Son leading the line than it is with Kane or you know, with him, with anyone else in that attack, really. Because Kane, what was so excellent about him, aside from the fact that he's just a brilliant finisher and very good at understanding where to be inside the box, but he's good at holding the ball up, playing with his back to goal and bringing other people into play, which that isn't so much Son's game, right? You're talking about a team that, as soon as Kane goes off, is going to be built more to stretch the pitch, is going to be built more to play fast and to look for those quick breaks. And whether or not it's better is by the by, it is different. And I think if you're especially in an in-game situation, it can be something different to think about. And perhaps also, even if you're preparing a game, you prepare differently to face a team with Harry Kane and the one that you don't.
I wouldn't imagine they'll be particularly hamstrung without Kane. Obviously, you'd rather have him available than not. But I think, you know, I don't think it'll be a major issue for Spurs if they actually sold Kane. I think taking the money they would get.
He's one of their own, Barry.
Well, yes.
He's one of their own.
But I don't think it'll be an insurmountable loss for them.
The question with Kane going forward, I wouldn't go quite as far as that, but these ankle injuries, man. I mean, he's done his right one 3 times, and this is the second time he's done his left one. Now, we don't know how bad it is just yet. I mean, this is an ill-timed recording in that regard, but if it is a bad one.
Yeah, the scan is today. We're recording it.
I mean, 11 o'clock it's interesting to me that he seems to be working on his game with regards to dropping deeper and being more of a playmaker and working on his passing game. All of these ankle injuries surely will have some kind of effect on his physicality and his speed and his ability to burst past people and get into positions. So adapting himself to a slightly more withdrawn role might be clever in the long run with that regard, but it will change him as a player, surely, in some way.
But he's still quite young, Harry Kane, comparatively. You know, to be getting these kind of wear and tear injuries, which is the ones he seems to be suffering most of, especially with his ankles.
And once the ankles, when they repeatedly get injured, it's tends to never stop happening. I mean, look at Andy Carroll, look at Jack Wilshere.
Yeah.
They're, you know, constantly unavailable, and it's always the same thing, really, isn't it?
The main talking point is the VAR penalty. You know, the ball hit Danny Rose's arm, it went out for a corner. Crucially, I think no one appealed, and then the referee checked the video.
Is that crucial?
And he gave a penalty. Well, I don't know. I think the players on the pitch tend to have a feeling about if something should be given or not, bearing in mind that in a game of that magnitude, they will appeal for anything. And no one thought it was a penalty. And then suddenly it went to VAR, and it's been given. What did you make of it, Paolo?
I thought by the interpretations of the law that have been in act in Europe all season, that's a penalty. I don't agree that that should be a penalty, but I think that's by the by. I think we can go around in circles and chase our tail forever on that point. But I think it felt especially tough because when you see the replay in super slow motion, you can see that Rose is clearly trying to draw his arm back. And I thought that was discussed in the BT Sport coverage well, the fact that actually at a certain point you have to allow for the fact that it's almost impossible to move your body without your arms sort of flapping somewhere.
You can't defend with your arms behind your back.
But I also think that... again, we know what the interpretation is. We've been surprised by it all season over and over again somehow, but that is the interpretation. The referee, once he's looked at the replay, has seen a handball, and I'm okay with it. You know, I think in the end, what football fans say most often when they're frustrated, except when it's against their team, is what we want is consistency. Well, here's your consistency. That's the way it's being applied.
I get the suspicion that... when you have children, you will be a very strict father, Paul.
I might not have children.
Well, if you do, I fear for them. Fernandinho, should he have been sent off for what looked like a deliberate elbow on Harry Kane?
I don't think so.
Okay, let's go around the table. Lars.
I'd like to quote Jonathan Wilson from the paper. I think he has a great line. It's a curiosity that VAR has led to strict liability for the ball striking an elbow, but not for an elbow striking a head. I don't know. I don't mind. I wouldn't mind. But I think it's weird that he doesn't get it. Well, the referee doesn't see it, so he doesn't get a yellow. But yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing a red for that sort of thing. I mean, the guy elbowed him in the head. You're not really allowed to do that. I think it just about is violent conduct. So, yeah.
I don't disagree with Lars. I just realised that everyone else got asked who they think Tottenham can get through this tie, and I didn't, and I think they will. So I wanted to be the dissenting voice. I think Tottenham are going to go through.
Spurs in the semi-final of the Champions League.
I think so. I think they score early away to City, and City completely lose their cool.
It would be entertaining. I like watching great teams lose their cool, I must admit. Manchester United 0, Barcelona 1. Luke Shaw own goal. Not a great game for him. He's missing the next leg because he's suspended. They started with the midfield of Pogba, McTominay and Fred in a Champions League quarterfinal against Barcelona. Barry, what did you make of it?
Not only was it not a good game for Luke Shaw, I didn't just thought it wasn't a very good game at all. I think there's clear gulf in class between the two sides, despite the fact that Barcelona weren't anywhere near their best. They didn't seem to come out of second gear during the game, dominated for long spells, and it's a weird one because they've got their 1-0 lead. It's a good result. They've got an away goal, but I can see Manchester United scoring at Camp Nou, and I don't think it's the foregone conclusion that quite a few others seem to, just going on what I've seen, you know, perusing the internet this morning. So I think even though they lost, Manchester United had dodged a bullet.
I'm not sure they can do it again like they did against PSG in the last round. What? I think Barcelona surely are too shrewd and too savvy to...
Well, Barcelona have some very recent history of blowing a game, a Champions League tie, which seemed to be in the bag, obviously, against Roma. The thing is that Barcelona actually have fairly dreadful, sort of in keeping with their former manager Pep, a fairly dreadful away form in Champions League knockout ties in recent times. So the fact they've won away from home and then they get to take it back to the Camp Nou suggests they're probably fine. I think it's, you know... It's worth saying in this game, again, we talk about early goals. United, it wasn't a thriller-minute performance, certainly, but United with a midfield of Fred, Pogba and McTominay, they let Barcelona have a total of 6 shots. I mean, it wasn't like they ever got overrun. And I think that... funny, you know, this is a...
Well, they had 30% possession.
Yeah, absolutely, sure. And
they didn't have a shot on target in the whole game.
And they clearly took a sort of... a very sort of reactive position. And I think that's, again, look at that midfield. Fine, poor Pogba, but then alongside him, Fred and McTominay. What are you expecting against Busquets, Rakitic and Arthur? Are you expecting them to hoard possession? Of course you're not. And funnily enough, this is my Italian-centric perspective on everything coming out, but I was thinking that Solskjaer, as a manager who's come in and taken on a job as a former, much-loved former player who hasn't necessarily been sort of considered as a great tactical mind, it's not dissimilar to what's happened a bit with Gattuso at times this season, where he's built a midfield that's very functional and hard-working and good at destroying, but not necessarily so good at creating. And of course, he talked about for the second leg, we need to create chances for our attackers, we need to get crosses in for whoever it is who's starting. And I think that is clearly a much bigger challenge against this Barcelona team. It's one thing to say, all right, well, we let you have the ball and we think we can shut up shop. But still, I don't think it's to be thrown out completely that they didn't get overrun, which I think a lot of people expected them to. And that's also a reason why Barry can say they might have a chance to second legs. If you don't get overrun, then you give yourself a chance of pinching a goal somewhere.
Yeah, I thought they'd get absolutely smashed. If you look at the names on the team sheet, I mean, how many United players would get in the Barcelona 11 there? 2, maybe? De Gea and Pogba, you'd say, possibly. But De Gea versus Ter Stegen isn't an obvious one either. So, I mean... man for man, Barcelona have a much, much better team, and they have possibly the best player of all time, who's having a very good season, even by his standards. So I thought they'd get smashed, and they didn't. They were alive in the tie, and, you know, I think that's... I don't want to lower the bar too much for Man United, but I think, all things considered, that's not a terrible, terrible outcome.
They've done so well under Solskjaer in the league, though. I think it's quite sobering when you look at those teams... man for man, Man United versus Barcelona, you can really see the gulf in class and the amount of work Solskjaer's got on his plate.
Well, crucially, the amount of work the club has to do with regards to putting together a squad that makes sense, and that's not Solskjaer's job primarily. It's not going to be. So however they move forward in terms of recruitment, whether they appoint a director of football or not, and I don't know, but there are bigger structural issues at Man United that they have to fix. And in a way, having a dip after the sort of winter euphoria of Solskjaer coming in and them smashing all these terrible teams, I think having a dip now, so they have a bit of a reality check moving into the summer, and they see very clearly in front of them that this team needs to be improved and needs to be strengthened, and that could be very useful for the club in the long run.
Well, Ander Herrera could go to PSG, Mata could leave, Antonio Valencia's been really used by Solskjaer, he could go, David De Gea's contract runs out. Did you read the article, the Daniel Taylor one, about how Old Trafford's just a bit shabby?
Yeah, that's just indicative of sort of the decline under the Glazers, that they're not prepared to invest. And Old Trafford, which is this, you know, famous monument of European football, is looking dilapidated and,
yeah,
you know, needs a lick of paint. It's just shabby, and it's kind of indicative of
the
players on the field as well.
They don't hold major European finals there anymore because it's a bit dilapidated and a bit shabby.
Yeah, and obviously Tottenham have now raised the bar to a ridiculous level.
Has anyone been?
No, not yet.
I'm
looking forward to it, though.
You know what I mean? It looks like it's come from space, doesn't it? It's extraordinary. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be doing at Man United over the summer.
You've just got me thinking now, because the Glazers, of course, are the owners of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFL, and the Buccaneers' home stadium has a big pirate ship behind one of the end zones, and when there's touchdowns, it fires fake cannons. Sort of trying to imagine what a new Old Trafford might look like, maybe with a giant devil sort of
roars, trident,
breathes fire. Or
don't give them ideas.
Is the honeymoon period over for Ollie now? Because they've lost, is it 4 and 5, 5 and 6?
Well, they've played much better teams. I mean, they've lost against Wolves, who are very good, as we know. They've lost against Arsenal, and they lost against flipping Barcelona. Right? I mean, we're all at the mercy of the fixture lists when it comes to the narratives and all this sort of stuff. You know, they're not sort of, they're not playing Bournemouth no more, and the results are going to be different.
And he's so popular at Old Trafford. He's a Teflon Oli.
Oh, there's no one Teflon in football.
No.
Is there?
No. Oh, no, you're quite right.
Us fans can be a fickle bunch.
Yes.
What would really worry me if I was the Man United hierarchy is the fact that Pogba's regressing again. It was understandable, I think, under Mourinho, because that was clearly a terrible mismatch in terms of the manager or the personality and what sort of conditions the player needs to thrive. I think that's obvious. But with Mourinho gone, he has a guy in him that really wants to build a team around him, that really wants to, is a positive manager, wants to give him confidence, go out there and do it, Pogba. And you had that magnificent burst where you saw in a run of games, albeit against poor opposition, that he can be an enormous player. But he's regressing again now, and he's giving these sort of really meh 5 out of 10 performances repeatedly, even though Solskjaer will just really bend over backwards to give him exactly what he wants on the pitch to perform. And you see, even Solskjaer, I think he will approach this problem differently than Mourinho would have, because he's a very, very different character. But you see him hinting in the press that, maybe we need to play him deeper. So he's running into the exact same problems that Mourinho had with Pogba. And I don't know, man, if Real Madrid really want him and are prepared to throw massive money at him in the summer, and United know they have a big rebuild of their own to fund, that's a decision to make, I think.
How much would he go for?
Don't know, honestly. Pogba.
It'd be something, you know, cataclysmic, wouldn't it?
But that's the other thing.
How many hospitals?
Real Madrid don't have unlimited funds anymore, so that's another part of that equation, I suppose.
Well, I've no idea how much a hospital costs, but Real Madrid do have a Gareth Bale they don't want. Manchester United are apparently interested in him. I'm not sure that would be a particularly wise acquisition given his history of injuries. I suspect Ellis will disagree.
Don't criticise Gareth
Bale. Because you love Gareth Bale. And, you know, we'll wait till later and I should start criticising Chris Coleman.
I think you're onto something there, Baz, though.
You know,
I want to put my own stamp on this podcast. This is a shop window for me, but this is.
But you've got your big money move from Radio X to Five Live. You don't need to be in the shop window. Robbins.
Oh, one of the terms of the contract is we will not criticise Gareth Bale on BBC Radio 5 Live. He's untouchable. I mean, oddly, from a Welsh perspective, I don't want him to go to the Premier League where the game is faster and there are more games and there's another cup competition. I would like him to play 5 times a year and just to mollycoddle him, wrap him up in cotton wool so he can play for Wales until he's 40. Because of the injury problems he's had at Real Madrid, I certainly don't want him to come into.
Well, what about now that you've secured your big money move to Five Live, you could sign Gareth Bale and just have him around the house for occasional kickabouts, five-a-sides.
I'll put my hand in my pocket.
And then keep him safe for Wales.
I just the idea of him getting injured at Bournemouth playing for Man United. Oh, God.
Even Ellis will have to be careful, though, because there's been famous instances of footballers injuring themselves reaching for remotes and the like.
Dave Besant, salad cream falling out of the cupboard in his kitchen, which he decided to trap with his foot.
We've all done that.
We've all done it. Jason Kumas, fertiliser in his eye. He didn't turn up for training. I think it might have been for a Wales game, actually, because he had fertiliser in his eye.
So under Barry's scheme, really, you'd need to hire someone else then to monitor Bale at all times and make sure he's not.
I'm willing to do that. I am willing to do that.
We need to put him in some sort of relaxation chamber. Some sort of, he's not, like in Father Ted, like the sheep they put in the lonesome float. I think that's what we need to do with Gareth Bale.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, to get back to my original point, Real Madrid have a lot of players they don't particularly want who are worth a lot of money. So if they really wanted to get Pogba in, it's utterly feasible.
Well, to end on a lighter note, an incredible statistic which came out of last night's game. Only 2 currently active players have scored more goals against the Premier League's Big Six than Messi. Sergio Aguero and Jamie Vardy, Messi being the only one on the list who's never played in the Premier League. He is quite good, isn't he, Messi? He is quite impressive.
He has talent, it must be said. He didn't play particularly well last night. I think he was nursing a groin strain, and he clearly wasn't making too much of an effort to exercise himself. And
still decided the game, though. So.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's magnificent.
You say he decided the game, but I believe it was not for the first time in Barcelona's recent history, own goal that decided the game. I saw an Opta stat pop up on my timeline yesterday. Since last season in the Champions League, Lionel Messi, Barcelona's top scorer in the Champions League, Lionel Messi, 14 goals. Second place, own goals with 6.
Really?
Yeah.
He took a nasty whack in the face as well, Messi, last night. Did you see that in the eye and
I don't remember
nose?
That.
Mm-hmm. Was it Chris Smalling?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that will do for part one. In part two, we will start with Liverpool's win over Porto.
It's time to focus.
The mood in the UK right now, it seems to me, is a huge set of tensions and contradictions and emotions and feelings about our past, and we're not thinking very much about the future.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two. Before we get back to it, on the 22nd of April at SWG3 in Glasgow, it's a live show. Max, Barry, Ewan Murray, Jonathan Wilson, it's Aldridge, Barnes, Beardsley. 23rd of April at the Elmwood Hall in Belfast, Max, Barry, Ewan Murray, Lars Sivertsen, it's Scholes, Keane, Giggs, Beckham. And a brand new show on the 10th of May at Earth in Hackney. It's Max, Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Lars Sivertsen. And I've just realised that I've run out of a classic sort of triumvirate of... Okay, Xavi, Iniesta, Messi. There you go. What a lineup! That's a new show. Barry, looking forward to it?
Always. I do like the live shows. So please come along.
Yes. Lars, how many live shows have you done?
5? Question mark. Yes, 5.
Okay, Liverpool 2, Porto 0 at Anfield. Naby Keita and Firmino scoring for Liverpool at Anfield. It was a pretty regulation win for Liverpool. Barry, have they got one foot in the next round?
It was quite a regulation win, and you would imagine they will go on to proceed to the semi-finals. And yet Porto should have scored in this game at least once. There, Musa Moraga is their man up front, fast, strong. He's, I think, 3rd in the top scorer list of this year's Champions League, but he hasn't been in good form recently. But he had 2 or 3 good chances in that game against Liverpool and wasn't clinical enough to finish them. Porto were also unlucky in that they were missing 2 of their most experienced players in Hector Herrera and the bald Pepe, who was obviously suspended. Interesting, actually, or not, Pepe was suspended because he got 3 yellow cards. 2 of them he picked up with, I think it was Beşiktaş, playing with them in the Europa League. So they obviously carry over. And Liverpool, for their part, they were missing Andy Robertson for the daft yellow he picked up against Bayern Munich. But yeah, it was quite comfortable. But Porto will feel they really should have scored. And if they had, that would make it very interesting for the second leg. Interesting use of VAR in this game as well. Mo Salah was very, very lucky, in my opinion, not to get sent off.
Yeah, absolutely.
For a late, high tackle.
It looks awful in the replay.
Yeah. And for the ref to look, or the VAR official, the ref kept consulting the VAR. He never went over and consulted the TV on the touchline himself. But, and he made a number of weird decisions, you know, consulting about things that weren't clear or obvious errors. You know, penalties that no one were calling for or anything. And he was consulting as well at the behest of players. Now, players aren't allowed, asked the ref, to consult VAR. And I've a feeling it might even be a bookable offence. But they're all doing it and no one's getting booked for it. And the refs are obviously starting to doubt themselves. But again, Mo Salah was incredibly lucky not to get sent off, in my opinion.
What did you make of the Liverpool-Porto game, Paolo?
Yeah, it was... I mean, it was always the sort of the tie in the round which you looked at and thought there was a... I don't know, at least I felt like it was one which I looked at and saw what felt like a clear favourite more than any of the other games. And it, on paper it played out that way. It certainly, Liverpool could have scored even more. But equally, Moussa Marega was apparently very sick all day. Had been throwing up in the game. He has a couple of great chances to win the game. He's been Porto's absolute star man throughout the tournament. You think if he's a little bit sharper, this game could end very differently. Or indeed, if Alexander-Arnold gets penalised, another potential sort of VAR discussion for handling the ball in the area at the end and they score a penalty. So... It's not so far away from being exactly what Porto did in the last round, which is lose 2-1 away from home in a game when they probably could have lost by more, and then they get to take it back home and maybe do something with it. At 2-0, it feels like it's probably done. But it was sort of simultaneously completely feels like, well, Liverpool were good enough value for that. They played well. But equally, there were chances for Porto to turn it into something closer.
Season's really shaping up for Liverpool, though.
Yeah, there were a couple of notable Liverpool things here, I thought. One of which being another good game by Naby Keita. I think him starting to find his feet at the club is really important because he gives them a bit of thrust from midfield.
After such a slow start.
Yeah, they have a lot of midfielders who are sort of diligent guys who run around a lot. But, I mean, in terms of progressing progressing the ball and getting the ball forward, either through good passes or just going past people, and also an added goal threat, he adds a lot that they're lacking.
Because I'm not sure how good he can be. Because he has had a disappointing start to his Liverpool career. But over the last couple of weeks, you've seen flashes of the player that they hoped they were signing.
Yeah. Definitely, and I think there's been an issue with him, whether he's not been quite right physically. It's been suggested that he's and since his game is a lot, he's also about running around a lot, so he needs to be right physically. The other thing that I think is important for Liverpool going forward is, surely now we all accept that Fabinho is the best player at the club for the deep midfield role. Like, I mean, that's where Fabinho needs to be and should be. And for Henderson, actually, him moving slightly further up the pitch, I think is a better use of his energy. I've never been massively sold on him as the anchor of the midfield. I don't think that's his natural position. I don't think he's wild about playing there himself either, to be honest. I think when you allow him to run around a bit more further up the pitch and actually attack the box a little bit, I think that's a better place for him to be.
Of course, the winners of this tie will face the winners of Manchester United versus Barcelona, which is pretty mouth-watering.
Depending on who the winner is.
Well, I
joke. It'll be fine. It'll be great.
Porto Man U, the game they're all talking about.
As a neutral, Liverpool could win the European Cup. How old am I? Liverpool could win the Champions League and the league.
Well, that's
or they could win all of their remaining games in the Premier League and still lose the title to Man City. It's a fantastically odd season for the neutral.
Yeah, and nobody seems to be talking about a Liverpool double.
No, no.
But everyone's talking about a potential Man City quadruple or quintuple if, like Pep, you're going to go all Jose and insist on encountering the community shield.
Enjoy that. It's bonkers, but it's funny. Yeah. It's going full Jose. You never go full Jose.
Yeah.
But this sort of, the Champions League feels like a kind of free swing for Liverpool because it's all about the league for them.
Yeah.
And if they win the Champions League and don't win the Premier League, I wonder if their fans would perhaps feel a little underwhelmed by that incredible success.
And it would really wind up everyone at UEFA because they want Champions League to take precedence, but I've not met a single Liverpool fan ever who would prefer to win the Champions League over the Premier League. They haven't won the league since 1990. They're all desperate to do it. They all go a little bit crazy during league fixtures because it means so much to them. Whereas it is a slight free swing, the Champions League, especially playing Porto, who are the weakest team left in the competition. They just seem to Liverpool just seem to relax a bit more when they're playing in the Champions League.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. I've spoken to lots of Liverpool fans about this in recent times, and to a man and woman, they all absolutely want to win the league. And it would be, I hadn't really sort of taken that thought on to how sort of bizarre it would be if they were to win every game they had left this season, not win the league and win the Champions League. Would
yeah,
be.
2018-2019, the forgotten year when they just won the Champions League. Ajax won, Juventus won, another first leg at home where Ajax completely dominated but couldn't win. They had 61% possession, 19 shots compared to Juventus's 7. Paolo, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, Ajax were, as they were in the last round against Real Madrid, they were spellbinding for parts of this game. I mean, they are an absolutely joyous team to watch when everything's humming. It was sort of strange. In the first half, it felt like there were flashes of good stuff, but and definitely chances, but they weren't sort of, they were almost being, if I don't know, subdued reasonably well by Juventus. But
they're very streetwise, aren't they, Juventus?
Well, I mean, Juventus came with a very clear idea of how they wanted to play, and it was very much to say, okay, you know, you do your exuberant thing, and we're going to be efficient and not give you chances. And it kind of worked. I thought sort of. There were areas of the pitch in which each team sort of got the better of the other. I mean, Ajax very clearly set out, because Juventus are missing several important players, but especially Giorgio Chiellini and Emre Can. Chiellini, everyone knows what he is, a defender, but Emre Can, interestingly, in the last round against Atletico Madrid, he was sort of the great revelation. You draw him back and play a sort of fluid back three that where he steps out and comes into midfield, and he played very, very well there, and it allowed Juventus to distribute the ball really well out the back. Without either of them, Ajax knew very well that there's only one player who wants to play the ball out from Juventus' back four as they lined up, which was Bonucci. They pressed him very aggressively and left the ball to Daniele Rugani, who's younger and less experienced and not very good at distributing the ball, and that was a very sort of effective area of the pitch. They also got on top of Miralem Pjanic really well in this game as well, and he had an awful game. On the other hand, they, like so many teams before them, weren't able to contain Cristiano Ronaldo. They also didn't do a good job with Federico Bernardeschi, who had a really good game. But Ronaldo, of course, is the player who defines this game from a Juventus standpoint, because the goal isn't just that he scores it, it's all about him. He takes a pass from Bentancur in the middle of the field. He feels that Ajax press, which was coming, you know, all over the pitch. Ajax are pressing it very aggressively and just immediately plays it out to Cancelo on the wing. I thought it was just such an intelligent ball. When you watch it back, he knows exactly where his opponent is and goes, fine, out it goes there, spins off the back of him and runs into a wide open space behind him and scores. And yeah, you know, same conversation as last round. That's why they signed Ronaldo to win Champions League games. But Ajax were brilliant. They came back with a fabulous, fabulous goal from Neres. And I think this second leg is going to be fascinating, because it's a better situation on paper for them than what they went into away at Real Madrid, isn't it? So,
well, they've scored 100 league goals this season, Ajax. You know, they're top of the table in Holland. History is on Juventus' side. On the 7 occasions Juve have drawn the first leg, won all away from home in the Champions League or the European Cup, Juventus have qualified 6 times, including against Ajax in 1978. Do you think Ajax have got it in them, Lars?
I'm going to be the cynic here. I don't think they do. I mean, as much as they were great, 1-1 is not a great result in the first game of these two. And yeah, they went away and beat Real Madrid, but Juventus have got their stuff so much more together than Real Madrid do. And I think that just the experience they have. I mean, yeah, they've scored 100 goals, but it's in the Dutch league, guys. You know, they don't count as much as proper goals, you know. It's not. And I do love watching this Ajax team. I think it's great that it is still actually possible for a team outside the big five leagues to progress to this point of the Champions League. Particularly fascinated with Dusan Tadic's role, playing nominally as a centre forward, but just wandering all over the pitch and creating space. Now it's great. It's great to watch. I just think Juventus is a terrible team for them to come up against, because I think that street smartness that they have will eventually see them get through.
I think you're right. Juventus are clearly going in as favourites now, and they're playing at home, and they are street smart. And even in this game, I thought a lot of things they were smart, but they weren't. They weren't smarter all over the pitch. Like I say, Pjanic, who is normally so essential to how Juventus play, I thought Van de Beek, who doesn't always get as much attention as the other sort of members of that attack. I feel like Ziyech and Neres, certainly in this game, were more showy. They were creating, you know, they were the ones getting into the box, taking shots, or in Ziyech's case, just taking shots from everywhere. But Van de Beek is such a, I don't know, it's such an all-rounder. He's physical. He was able to use his strength and his sort of his power to get on top of Pjanic. But he also has this great sense of timing in when he joins the attack and steps forward as well. So that whole bank of three is just such a talented trio. And I think, yeah, they'll go to Juventus and it won't be 60% possession like it was here, I don't think. It'll be a different game. And I think that unquestionably, even as we saw late in this game, when Douglas Costa comes off the bench, comes out of, I don't know, whatever cave he's been living in for the last several months, not playing football, and nearly scores, just absolutely destroys his man and hits the post. Ajax are vulnerable and will continue to be vulnerable. And with Cristiano Ronaldo, yeah, you expect at home Juventus are going to score goals. They also didn't even use their own sort of secret weapon off bench, Moise Kean. But I also fully believe that this Ajax team can go to Turin and score as well. That's the thing. I think that in the same way as they went to Madrid and scored four, all right, maybe they won't score four in Turin, but I believe they can go to Juventus and score goals. So while the away goal is definitely important and meaningful for Juventus, it's not like it would be for another team. You're like, oh, the away goal, really, is it going to finish 0-0? This game will not finish 0-0 in Turin. I think that's what I'm really trying to say. There are good, something will happen in the return leg, for sure.
Before we move on to Ajax and Frankie de Jong, I'm going to take advantage of your presence on the pod to push my Welsh agenda. How do you see Aaron Ramsey fitting in at Juventus? Talk to me, Paolo.
So,
they don't really have a player like him, do they?
I think they do and they don't. And Blaise Matuidi, who actually, that's another important point of this game. Juventus, who are already missing a couple of players, we mentioned Blaise Matuidi picked up a knock here, and if he misses the second leg, Juventus are running a little bit thin of options. Blaise Matuidi's a box-to-box midfielder. Bernardeschi, who's been playing more as a winger this season, he's a box-to-box guy. You certainly can play him in the middle and do that, which is what I guess we think was Ramsey. I think Ramsey does his best work even a little bit further advanced than that, doesn't he? Where he's just sort of playing more behind the attack and has that opportunity to break the lines. I've seen a lot of scepticism about him. I've heard a lot of scepticism.
Please
about him.
Please don't criticize Aaron Ramsey.
and actually, no. I mean, I've been generally on the side of, I think it's an interesting investment. I think I look at the team that Juventus have right now, and I sort of don't see where you're fitting him in, especially when you have, I mean, everything has to work around Ronaldo now. It has to work around Ronaldo for at least the next couple of years because you spent 100 million on him. You've got players already there, although perhaps some of them like Paulo Dybala could be on the way out because he looks less and less like he fits in this team. But you have already this sort of, I don't know, excess of players who play in and around the attack, from Dybala to Bernardeschi to Douglas Costa to Moise Kean. Creating a balanced formation that fits Ramsey in it as a slightly, really, I think he's a brilliant player, but he's he can feel like a luxury player sometimes in that you can't have him, I don't think, in a midfield and expect him to do everything for you. You have to give him the freedom to be part of the attack. I don't know quite how it works tactically. I do think that Max Allegri is a manager who is very good at working out how things, you know, different sets of players can go together tactically. He's done it every year at Juventus, players coming in and out. And I think that Ramsey is very much talented enough to be a success somewhere like Juventus. So I'm sort of torn between optimism about the talent and the potential, but also not quite seeing how it would work with the current 11. But again, there's a manager there who's very good at answering those riddles.
He put on Instagram, and frustratingly, I can't remember who it was who answered, but he put on Instagram to say how pleased he was to be moving to Italy and to sign for Juventus. And one of the first comments was from a Juve player who said, yeah, you're here to work. And it was, you know, you don't see footballers talking to each other on social media in those terms usually. Mm. And I thought it was quite telling. So who knows? I personally, I really hope it works out for him. Frankie de Jong, a huge performance from him, Barry. What a young player he is.
I haven't seen him play very often. I think I've seen 3 Ajax games this season, but was he not at fault for the goal?
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of initially there.
So, I mean, that doesn't mean he's a terrible player, but...
Yeah, he's got a mistake in him.
haven't we all? yeah, so I wouldn't be able to talk. He's clearly in huge demand, but I'm not.
But he also, I think it was him who made those... there was a moment in the... there was a moment when Benedeschi went clean through and it was a last-ditch tackle. I think that was De Jong as well. Mm. So, yeah, he certainly had his good moment.
Well, he made 90 successful passes and he looks to be on the way to Barcelona in the summer. He recovered the ball 11 times.
That's confirmed already, isn't it, though?
Oh, is it? Okay. It is.
Did I dream that?
No, he is on his way to Barcelona. Yeah. That has been confirmed. He's 21 years of age.
Well, the plucky little minnows of Ajax, you know, for a team of European minnows with no pedigree whatsoever, they have an astonishing record when it comes to developing young players and selling them on for a huge fee.
Yeah.
I will be rooting for them in
the European Southampton.
I will be rooting for them in the second leg because I've had it with Juventus.
It's good versus evil, that.
A horrible team.
So many ways, especially if Kane stays on the bench. If he comes on, it balances it a bit. But
I think I dislike Juventus more than I do Real Madrid now, and that's quite some feat.
Why's that?
Well, there are a long history of cheating, and then this whole Cristiano Ronaldo business is just thoroughly unpleasant, and the way it's being handled leaves a very bad taste. And what also annoys me is the way people consistently just don't mention it when Juventus and Cristiano Ronaldo are being discussed.
I share a lot of your feelings on this, Baz, but I also sometimes feel like I don't know what people would like us to say every time. I mean, there is an outstanding allegation, which, short of being tried in a court of law, we can't adjudicate on here in a podcast.
You know, I think the wider issue is, as Barry alluded to there, you know, plucky minnows Ajax have won a mere 4 Champions League titles, a mere 1 European Cup Winners' Cup, only 1 UEFA Cup, 2 UEFA Super Cups.
But that's like invoking like the old Corinthians. I mean, there was a different reality. I mean, it's very rare for a team outside, it's not normal for a team outside the big 5 leagues to make it to this stage. And I mean, I don't have the numbers at hand right now, but I remember when they made it to the final of the Europa League and played United. I mean, they had the wage budget of a sort of mid-table championship team. I mean, in this context, they are plucky minnows.
Yes, yeah. It just, for anyone who's vaguely interested in the history of the game, it's bizarre to refer to them as minnows. But
I think it's possible to both be interested in the history, to be aware of the history, and also acknowledge what the situation is right now.
Yeah, yes. But, you know, it is quite the young team that they've got, that they seem to have developed. The captain, Delitt, he is 19. I googled it just before we started recording. He was born on the 12th of August 1999, which means that there are Tamagotchis older than him, which makes me want to spew blood. But still, you know, from European minnows to Premier League minnows, Chelsea 2, West Ham 0, Hazard scoring both goals, including a wonderful solo effort from him in the first half.
They'll miss him when he's gone.
Well, he's house hunting in Madrid, apparently. You know, that move to Real seems to be sewn up. What is the future for Chelsea if Eden Hazard goes?
They'll cope. They'll have to cope, I suppose. But I'll miss watching them play, certainly.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, there are certain... I have no particular affinity for Chelsea whatsoever, but I love what... There are certain players I love watching play, and he's one of them. And he seems a real likeable guy. He's always been quite open, you know, feels questions about his future, seems to change his mind with the weather, and why not? Yeah, he's just a likeable character and a brilliant footballer. And if he leaves and Chelsea have this transfer ban to cope with, I mean, we joke that they have, you know, they're not exactly going to be on thin gruel because they've got 40 players out on loan at other clubs and other good young players. at the team or at the club who rarely get an opportunity, but he is just something out of this world, and he would be a huge loss, particularly now that Maurizio Sarri has confirmed that Danny Drinkwater is not in his plans and does not have a future at the club.
Yes.
What now for Danny, who has made headlines for not drinking water, for drinking other things, and then getting behind the wheel of his car? So not been a good week for Danny.
No, it must not have been a good season for him, is it?
Well, I think he's played 30 minutes of the Community Shield. And, you know, he was told at the start of the season that he would not be playing under Sarri, and he elected to stay anyway. One can only assume, I'll see if I can sit it out and he'll be gone.
And it looked likely at one stage, didn't it?
Yeah, but I'm not sure who's going to pay. He's contracted, I think, till 2022. So what's he going? Is he going to sit tight or
on 100 grand a week?
On 100 grand a week, or go elsewhere for less?
Who knows? Well, Chelsea moved into third with this win, so Spurs, Arsenal, and Man United are behind them, but all with a game in hand. And tonight, Chelsea play Slavia Prague in the Europa League quarterfinals. Ahead of the Slavia Prague game, could the pod do a tight five on the concept of Ethan Ampadu? This is a question from Andy Dudfield. He doesn't actually seem to have a defined position he plays in, nor a club that wants to give him a game, but is unquestionably magnificent. Is he modern football, Paolo?
I think all of us were sat here hoping that question to get thrown to someone else. Does he define modern football? No. How's that?
Well, he's also still extraordinarily young.
Yeah, I mean, he's a teenager of whom I haven't seen enough personally to offer a really sort of developed opinion, if I'm being absolutely honest.
He was born on the 14th of September 2000. I remember he got a Man of the Match award playing for Exeter when he was 15 or something ridiculous. I've watched him for Wales, and he is undoubtedly hugely talented.
Yeah.
But, you know, he occasionally makes naive decisions. He occasionally plays with that kind of freedom that comes with young players, where they don't seem to realise the magnitude of the game they're playing in. That said, he is 18, and you're going to make mistakes when you're 18.
What's his best decision? Some would say his hairstyle is a mistake he's made.
Yeah, he's got a slightly thin moustache, which makes him look a little bit like a car thief from Swansea, I think. So I would ask him to shave, personally.
What's his best position? Is he a centre-half or a defensive midfielder?
Well, I don't know which his best position is. He's played both whenever I've watched him. He's very, very comfortable on the ball and composed. My problem is that I keep mixing him up with Kwame Ampadu, his father, who used to play for the Swans in the 90s.
Right.
So I occasionally refer to him as Kwame by mistake. But
he seems sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place at Chelsea at the moment, because Sarri values him too much to send him out alone, but doesn't value him enough to give him a game. And you just see him sitting there on the bench all the time, which can't be particularly good for his development.
He plays in the League Cup occasionally. I mean, that's when I've watched him play for Chelsea.
Yeah.
And also I think a lot of those young players, they often struggle when they drop down to the Championship, because they're seen as big-time Charlies at their new clubs.
Yeah, but if he's picking up Man of the Match gongs while playing for Exeter as a 15-year-old, you'd imagine he'd be all right.
Because
he's muddied his spats before, you know.
That's true. While we're here, Arsenal host Napoli tonight. Paolo, you've got your eyes on both leagues. Who's in the better shape right now?
I mean, probably Arsenal, especially tonight because they're at home. Because, as we know, Arsenal are two completely distinct and unrelated teams when they are playing at the cauldron, the fortress, the terrifyingly imposing Emirates Stadium. I mean, I'm joking about that, of course, but clearly that the home and away form has been so dramatically different for Arsenal. It's hard not to consider that as an immediate factor. Napoli are going through a really odd phase. Napoli have sort of slipped into this comfort zone where they have no chance of catching Juventus. I mean, I think Juventus need one point this weekend to seal the title, but equally have would have to have the most absurdly calamitous end to the season now to not make the Champions League. So they're in this sort of weird no-pressure zone. And much as Carlo Ancelotti denies that that's why their performances have slipped, it feels an awful lot like that is why their performances have slipped. They've conceded in all of their last six games, which is, you know, very uncharacteristic how they were playing earlier in the season. Lorenzo Insigne has been pretty indifferent for a while now in his form, which, you know, is leading to questions about which attack we will see against Arsenal, because he sort of has a couple of different combinations he can choose from Ancelotti between Mertens and Milik or Mertens and Insigne, which create very different play styles, because Milik is a big target man and Insigne is more likely to sit deeper and play off Mertens as your number nine. So I would say Napoli are in indifferent form, but have reminded us what they're capable of just at the end of March when they walloped Roma 4-1. Arsenal, I thought, were playing very, very well until they had to go and play an away game on Monday. So, I would say Arsenal are in slightly better shape.
Righto, okay. That's the end of part two. There will be a Football League roundup in part three. In the Championship, before we get on to the results from this week, I'm going to give a special mention to Bolton Wanderers. You know, founder members of the Football League, four times FA Cup winners. They're one of England's historic clubs. I saw an amazing statistics on their Wikipedia page. No other club has spent as many seasons in the top flight without winning the league. Now, my brother-in-law Jacob is a big Bolton Wanderers fan, and I think anyone who keeps their eye out or keeps a general interest in the Football League will know that, you know, Bolton are undergoing this slow demise. But if you want it brought into sharp focus, they lost to Middlesbrough the other night. There was only about 12,000 there, but it looked like less. EastEnders was being shown on the concourse because there was no Sky or BT. That hasn't been paid. People were being served bags of crisps in the hospitality boxes because the caterers haven't been paid. And match officials were spotted having to eat in Subway before the game because there was no food to give them. They're being sued for £1 million by Forest Green Rovers over Christian Doige. Players are still not paid this month and were paid 3 weeks late last month. A few people are interested in buying the club, including previous Watford owner Lawrence Bassini, who's himself been banned from owning a Football League club.
And has been bankrupt twice.
Yeah. Every takeover bid seems to fall down at the due diligence stage. They've been to the High Court twice in the last month for a winding up petition from the HMRC. And since then, every other person seems to have popped up. So White's Hotel are in court today for a winding up petition raised by a company who supply TV and audio equipment, which has been reclaimed. And they're now facing a 12-month transfer embargo for owing football creditors for more than 30 days. It is an extraordinary, it's an extraordinarily sad story.
It is, and they also run the risk of losing loads of players for free because the players haven't been paid for March yet, and once your wages are 2 weeks late, you can, if you want, instigate proceedings to end your contract and move on elsewhere. And because staff are consistently being paid late, and it's not just players and coaching staff, it's also other staff who probably need, you know, are living more hand to mouth than the footballers themselves. It's very unfair, and their owner Ken Anderson, their current owner, is apparently he's asking for way too much money for a club that is essentially worthless.
Yeah.
On paper, and that's why all these prospective takeovers keep falling down at the last minute, because he's looking for ridiculous amounts of money. And as you said, this new guy, Lawrence Bassini, who's interested, I mean, he's a charlatan. I heard former Crystal Palace owner Simon Jordan, who I accept is not everyone's cup of tea, but is an interesting guy to listen to when he's talking about how it is to own a football club. He had very little good to say about him on TalkSport recently. So, yeah, it's a very, very worrying time for Bolton. But, yeah, it is stark when you say that, you know, it's things as simple as not having Sky, not being able to feed the match officials.
I got sent an amazing screen grab of fans on the concourse watching EastEnders on those televisions because they haven't paid the Sky or BT bill, which is just mind-bending. And
it seems a bit particular to then turn the tellies on. I mean, you could just sort of leave screens off and leave them blank. Yeah. But yeah,
but it's pretty gripping stuff, EastEnders. Yeah, yeah. And as someone who last night worked with Michelle Collins, aka Cindy Beale, it's an institution, EastEnders. Also, just the basics, the bread and butter that their next two championship home games against Ipswich and Middlesbrough were in doubt. Because they were issued with an order, they were issued with an order preventing fans from entering the ground, and then I think they were given £160,000 by the EFL. So the game against Middlesbrough took place, but there it's real. Well,
it's worth bringing up the EFL. Actually, it's interesting you mention them because the Bolton Supporters Trust voiced serious concerns to the EFL earlier this season about their owners. Ability to keep funding the club, and the EFL said they'd investigate, apparently did so, and came back and went, no, everything's fine, he'll be grand, it's not going to be a problem. And now this is happening, which shows the EFL were either misled or didn't conduct their investigation properly. So Sean Harvey, the EFL chief, who leaves at the end of the season, he has some questions to answer as well, and the Bolton Supporters Trust are looking for those answers. Whether or not they'll get them remains to be seen, because Sean Harvey as well has been associated with a few clubs that encountered serious financial difficulties in the past.
It's just the problem is you're not just running a business, you are a custodian for a community institution, and this keeps happening with football clubs, and I think it's tragic that for the fans of Bolton Wanderers or any club that's in financial difficulty, that you could have your football club taken away from you because of the actions of an irresponsible board and chairman. And you know, I know we were talking about Ajax in the second part and how they're now effectively minnows when it comes to their wage structure and how much money they've got to spend in comparison with clubs in Italy or England or Spain. But Bolton are they're Football League founder members. They are, you know, they're a big club with big support as well, certainly a dormant support. And I just, it's very, very sobering, and I think it's very, very sad. We'll move on. I'll just give you a quick championship roundup. Norwich were 1-0 down with 5 minutes to go, went 2-1 up, only for Reading to score a 97th minute equaliser. Leeds have closed the gap to 6 points with a 2-0 win at Preston. They leapfrog Sheffield United, who were held 1-1 at Birmingham. West Brom lost their second game in a row. They went down 3-2 at Bristol City, who'd gone 3-0 up after just 19 minutes.
It's really working out for West Brom since they sacked Darren Moore, isn't it? I absolutely love it.
Yeah. The bottom four all lost, but Millwall and Reading climbed above Wigan on goal difference and goals scored respectively. Still, those three and Rotherham desperately trying to avoid being the last side relegated to League One. And the Swans beat Stoke 3-1. Stoke, I mean, two players sent off early in the second half, but I've been asked specifically by Swansea fans not to talk up Graham Potter or Dan James in case people in wider football realise how good and talented they are, because I'd just like to confirm that Dan James's goal against Stoke was rubbish. Don't bother looking at it up. Not worth it. In League One, Sunderland drew 1-1 over Burton Albion to move back into the second automatic promotion place. Rochdale jumped from 23rd to 19th with a win at Accrington Stanley. They were one place above Wickham, who lost 1-0 to Charlton, who now haven't lost in 10, 6 wins and 4 draws. In League Two, there was a goalless draw between Swindon and Newport, who both actually have long shots at making the playoffs, and an 85th minute winner for Sol Campbell's Macclesfield, who beat Exeter 3-2. In women's football, England beat Spain 2-1 in their second friendly of the international break. Beth Mead and Ellen White with the goals at the County Ground in Swindon. And the Welsh women played two friendlies, both against the Czech Republic, drawing both of them 0-0 and 1-1. So let's move on to the Premier League this weekend. Liverpool versus Chelsea on Sunday, Barry.
Yes, it's a big game at Anfield. With Eden Hazard in the form he's in, I would be swallowing nervously if I was a Liverpool fan, but they've proved pretty resilient in the past. I'm really looking forward to this one. I couldn't tell you what way it's going to go.
I'm very suspicious of the Chelsea revival. Because if you look on paper, they've been good recently. They got 7 wins, a draw, and a defeat in all competitions in the last 9. But I'm very suspicious of it. And this is coming from someone. I'm not anti-Sarri at all. I quite like Sarri. I'm even a Jorginho apologist. But I'm not buying it because they've played. Okay, and those 7 wins they've played against, they've beaten Fulham, Dynamo Kiev twice, Cardiff, Brighton and West Ham. I mean, all right, there was the derby winning at Spurs, that was good. But they've played some really pitiful teams, like, in terms of the performances they've come up against. And I don't see this massive change in how they're going about things, really. I think they might struggle here.
Bad away record as well.
Yeah.
So Chelsea have won just one of their 7 away games at top half sides this season, losing the other 6. This is the big challenge for Liverpool on paper, because left to play Wolves in 8th, Newcastle in 15th, Cardiff City in 18th, and Huddersfield were obviously bottom. So if they get a good result against Chelsea at Anfield.
Yeah, and they beat, I mean, since they beat Porto 2-0, they're firmly in charge of that, so they don't have to worry about resting players for a difficult away leg there. They can comfortably field their strongest team. Again, I don't think Chelsea are fixed after their period of crisis. And I think the slightly sort of occasionally ponderous way in which Chelsea play passing the ball around, there should be ample chances for Liverpool to hit them on the counter, which is what they like to do. I think this could be a good weekend for Liverpool.
Crystal Palace versus Manchester City also on Sunday. The reverse fixture ended 3-2 to Palace, featuring that Andros Townsend screamer. What do you think, Paolo? Do you fancy Palace
wasn't that
at all?
I think that was the game which we had. There was a fan who tweeted something before the game, like, "I'll be happy if we just get a corner," and they didn't get a corner, but they won 3-2. So the Palace account retweeted them and said, "You know, you can't please everyone." Palace is somewhere that on paper shouldn't be easy to go away and play, because they have such a one of the few atmospheres in the Premier League that is actually a little bit hot and hostile. Like, it is one of the few places you go where it is actually a bit can feel a bit tasty. But they've been terrible at home this season, and for City it's another chance, isn't it, to move ahead of Liverpool for what, all of 20 minutes or whatever it'll be by the time the game finishes. Of course you expect City to win, and especially coming off that game against Tottenham midweek where they didn't play very well.
You're completely right. They have been terrible, and they're fascinatingly terrible, because you're right. It's a great stadium, Selhurst Park. It's one of the sort of antidotes to the sort of sterile modern Premier League atmosphere that's not as good as the packaging would suggest very often. I mean, it's always quite raucous there. It's a great place to go and watch football. But they've been so bad. I mean, only Fulham and Huddersfield have picked up fewer points at home this season than Palace. That's atrocious. And they've scored 13 in 16 games there.
Well, that is the weird thing. They still haven't conceded many goals at home.
No.
They actually haven't. And that's, the one thing that you rest on. But again, you know, City had won 22 out of 23 before they went to Tottenham. I mean, you expect an angry performance here.
But it gets weirder, because they scored 13 and 16 at home, but they actually produce an average of 16 shots per game. So only City produce more shots at home than Crystal Palace do, but they almost score almost no goals. So basically they miss a tremendous amount of chances at home for mysterious reasons, not all named Christian Benteke.
I mean, that is an interesting statistic.
It is.
I like that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pass that off as my own.
Well, actually,
a pub scenario, probably.
Just to nip some, I mean, they're not all long shots either. When you hear these sort of bizarre shot statistics, you think they're probably just like Townsend whacking it from 30 yards all the time. Only City produce more shots from within the penalty area at home than Palace do. So they're proper chances as well. They're just not scoring any goals. It's very strange.
What a fantastic sport. God, I love football. Anyway, Manu play West Ham. Could be another tough game for Manchester United, maybe. No.
You've been watching West Ham recently, have you?
Yeah. A huge game at the bottom, though. Burnley versus Cardiff City. Cardiff, they've got to win there. You know, they're on a poor run of form. I don't know. I'm not sure I can see it happening, personally. What do you think, Barry? Got a wry look on your face.
No, I'm just curious to know, would you greet the relegation of Cardiff with glee, or?
If I'm honest, I hate playing them. And you're meant to think, no, I want to play them and beat them. But I find those derby fixtures so stressful. So the Swans are on a very good run of form. We won our last three, playing QPR on Saturday at Loftus Road. But I just, I hate that game. The double has never been done in the South Wales Derby. In, you know, the fixture's 100 years old, over 100 years old, but it's never been managed. So I don't know. I'm not sure. There was a point in February when I thought that Cardiff were gonna manage it. They got a lot of good results after, you know, the tragic events around Emiliano Sala, but over the last few games they've been disappointing. So I don't know. I'm not sure myself. I've got some breaking news actually. Diego Costa has been handed an 8-game ban by the Spanish authorities. 4 games for handing the ref and 4 games for the insult he aimed at the ref, which was "I shit on your whore mother, I shit on your whore mother." That's a translation. That's his season over.
But is he not, as I understand it, he's contesting that he actually said "I shit on my whore mother," and it was more of a general sort of frustration thing he was saying. He wasn't aiming it at the referee, which would obviously put it in a completely different light. But anyway.
But does anyone say that?
But it's a thing in Spanish, I believe.
To say that you're shitting on your own whore mother.
It's more of a common... Like, in English, it would be an outlandish thing to say, but it's more of a common...
Very unexpected.
...common expletive.
I mean, if Barry said that, I'd be absolutely stunned.
I actually follow your mother on Twitter. So I wouldn't say anything about your mum. She seems very nice.
She's a very nice woman. Very, very nice woman.
I'm now imagining Barry getting sent off in a game by Ellis and him shouting, "I follow your mother on Twitter. She's a very nice..." Yeah.
I'm going to mute your whore mother.
My mum wants Cardiff City to stay up because she wants all the Welsh teams to do well because she likes them all. She is a very nice person. Yeah, that the Cardiff thing is weird because... You know, most Swansea fans, and vice versa, would want them to go down. I just find the derby such an uncomfortable thing. I don't really want to think about it, so I'm swerving that question.
But as you say, no one's done the double in ages. So
no one's done the double ever.
Yeah. So if they come down, are you more excited about the possibility of doing it, or more worried about the possibility of it being done to you?
I just find those games, they make me so anxious. And the prospect of them doing it over us for the first time in the fixture's history would make me feel very, very uncomfortable. But still, nice club. Wish them well.
Can I quickly clarify my Capella stat? I got excited, and it is true, only City produced more shots from within the penalty area at home, but it isn't true that only City produced more shots in general at home.
Right, okay.
It's still a tremendous stat.
It's still a tremendous stat.
Also, Benteke is terrible, I guess, is what we learned from all of this.
I think that's the take-home message. Just a little bit of A or B. On Monday, you were talking about the atmosphere at Vancouver Whitecaps versus LA Galaxy and how there were many people cheering for Zlatan. Among the many responses we received, there was one from Liam O'Shea, which read... "I'm living in Vancouver, but not from here. I was at the game, and every time Zlatan touched the ball, people were shouting abuse at him or booing. However, the Whitecaps themselves marketed the game as Whitecaps versus Zlatan, so I'd say that's why there were some people there just to see him. So it's not so it's not as much about fan culture, but marketing ploys." Barry, you've got a right to reply.
Well, he said that people were booing Zlatan. One of the Vancouver Whitecaps players complained after the game that their own fans were cheering Zlatan, and he was most unimpressed with this. You know, there are fans, they should be supporting us. A fellow called Keith Morgan sent me an email, and he said, "Further to the Whitecaps discussion, fans here have been very supportive for years, but many are pissed off at off-field moves. You will recall they sold Alphonso Davies to Bayern for $22 million. It was an MLS record, but many still thought it was a gift. When you see the silly money currently being spent in the European game, it does seem low. This, combined with extremely poor performance of a totally new team this season, is upsetting fans. It's hard to see where the money went. Vancouver has always been a soccer hotbed like Seattle, yet the Sounders are way ahead."
The thing I think is worth mentioning whenever we talk about supporter culture in the US is that it's a really big country with a lot of different teams and a lot of different types of people supporting their teams in different ways. And I think there's a tendency for us sort of stodgy Europeans to write it all off as nonsense. A couple of years ago, I went out to Seattle and to Portland, and I actually went to a derby between, you know, two of the proper teams over there. And I went with the away fans. I went on one of the buses. Shout out to the lads of the Barra Fuerza Verde and the rest of the ECS. And that, you know, there are some really good sort of pockets of exciting supporter culture, and it gets me a little bit annoyed when people write off all of MLS as nonsensical and plastic and stupid. So
no one on this pod did that.
Very good.
So
yeah, I would echo what Lars said. I also, just to be even fussier, because I know saw someone jumping in on this, I think you said country there, talking about a continent. Vancouver, of course, not in America.
Very good.
A very, very rational end to this podcast. Come on, I mean, if we can't be irrational football fans on Guardian Football Weekly, where can we be, is my answer. So just to sum up, I loathe the MLS. That is enough for today's Guardian Football Weekly. Thanks, Paolo. Thanks, Lars. Thanks, Barry. On Monday, Faye Carruthers will be presenting the show, and I will be back soon enough. Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.